I'm Jeffrey Church from the Department of Political Science at the University of Houston. This is the Political Theory Review, a podcast of conversations with authors of recent books in political theory and social and political philosophy. Today, I'm talking to Constantine Vasiliou, research fellow at the Civitas Institute at the University of Texas, Austin. We're discussing his recent book, Moderate Liberalism in the Scottish Enlightenment, from Edinburgh University Press. His research is on 18th century political thought, particularly the work of Montesquieu, Hume, and Smith, and he has published several articles and edited volumes on these thinkers. Okay, well, first of all, Constantine Vasiliou, welcome to the Political Theory Review.
Thank you for having me.
Constantine, this was a great book. I very much enjoyed it. It's a great analysis of Montesquieu on commerce and honor, as well as some of the supporting figures from the Scottish Enlightenment. I say that jokingly, but Montesquieu is really the central figure here. But you kind of have illustrative discussions about David Hume and Adam Smith and Adam Ferguson. So really great kind of sweeping discussion about commerce and virtue in the 18th century. So congratulations on the book. Let me ask you, first of all, what motivated you to write this book in the first place?
Well, I have several motivations. First of all, it's no secret that liberalism's institutional guardrails have become attenuated over the years. And for me, I could trace this back. A critical inflection point in our recent history is the subprime crisis and the Great Recession. I think it unleashed varied forms of populism that have been questioning the viability of the liberal state, its ability to balance, private commercial ends and concerns about the public interest. And so, as you know, there's various even scholars, right, who are beginning to question liberalism's viability. I'm sure you've heard of people like Patrick Deneen, right? The famous axiom, liberalism has failed because it succeeded. And I take that as a challenge to find conceptual resources in our liberal tradition that may help us restore our liberal foundations going forward. So that was probably my primary motivation. And also, you might have known this already, but I have a background in finance. And I was a trader doing margin calls, right? So I saw the risks associated with leveraging.
What years were you? I remind me from the book. Was it around the 2008?
Yeah, it was from 2006 to 2010. And 2009 is when I decided to return to the academy, but I was still working during the day and I was taking classes at night. And this is where I met my first academic mentor, James Moore, who was teaching this course on the Scottish Enlightenment, and Montesquieu had a cameo appearance in that course. And he said, you should take a closer look at Montesquieu and how he responded to to capitalism's first financial contagion crisis, right? Because it's an entry point into bigger questions he addresses in his liberal project. And so that's kind of how I got into it. And I saw that we could learn a lot from how he responded to questions, like, as you said in your introductory remarks, that we continue to grapple with to this very day.
Great. So, I very much enjoyed the sort of contemporary resonance of the book and its implications for liberalism. I also enjoyed the engagement with Montesquieu, who's you do a lot of work, and the book is a contribution in thinking about Montesquieu and his vision of a moderate liberalism, which you draw on. I was wondering maybe you could say a little bit about your reading of Montesquieu kind of overall. I mean, as I read what you're doing, I mean, the book is called Moderate Liberalism.
Yeah.
And scholars have previously noted the central feature of moderation in Montesquieu's view. But as I read what you're doing, I think you're pointing out that even those institutions that can facilitate moderation, specifically commercial institutions, can also be end up being immoderate if not checked in the right sort of way. Do I have you right there? Maybe you can expand on that.
Yeah, no, I think that's correct, right? Because on the one hand, and as scholars have famously noted, commerce is central, right, for understanding Montesquieu's liberalism, right? And in many instances, commerce is a source of moderation, right? The commercial virtues. But it can also become a source of immoderation, right? Commerce is not self-correcting, right? And there needs to be some sort of check against that. And this is something that preoccupied Montesquieu throughout his writings, right? Because he was, you know, to be clear, because sometimes, you know, my book really emphasizes his anxieties about commerce, but overall, he was a great promoter, a booster of commerce, you know, like folks like Mandeville and others. But, you know, to go back to that Deneen thesis, right? Montesquieu was of the mind that, you know, commerce might fail, right? Because it has succeeded, right? But it doesn't have to, right? So my book emphasizes more on his anxieties about the shadow side of commerce, right? Reminding even his pro-commerce contemporaries that, you know, it's modern commerce is an emergent practice that has conferred a lot of benefits in modern European societies, but it's not an unalloyed good, right? And
Yeah, no, I mean, I was going to say a lot of scholars of Montesquieu kind of focus on the spirit of the laws, I think, in this, and, you know, develop the interpretation of the unalloyed, you know, unconditional good of commerce. I mean, I one of the things I like about your book is you read the Persian letters, which, as you know, I'm a big fan of that book. So, yeah, I mean, maybe you could say a little bit about, sort of the textual basis for the reading. Do you, you know, you're focusing a lot on the Persian letters, kind of an early work of Montesquieu. Do you also see that kind of concern with commerce also still present in the spirit of the laws, or do you think he kind of changes his views about commerce as he gets older?
I think his concerns are consistent, right, about commerce, but his response to the problem evolves, right? So for example, you know, in the Persian letters, you know, Usbek, who's one of the main protagonists, right, is one of the travelers from Persia that, you know, goes to Europe and kind of documents his impressions of European society. But John Law, right, who's a Scottish financier, infamous for coming to France after Louis's death, Louis XIV's death. At this point, France just ended fighting this war for several years, the War of Spanish Succession. It was in financial crisis, had several bankruptcies, and he instituted this financial scheme to help sort out France's economic crisis. And it's a scheme that eventually went awry, led to the first major stock market crash in European history. It was a financial contagion crisis in the sense that the crisis spread all over Europe. And Montesquieu was preoccupied with John Law throughout the Persian letters. And he remains preoccupied with Law in the spirit of the laws, in a passage that I think is critical in the spirit of laws, where he refers to John Law as Europe's greatest promoter of despotism, right? The greatest promoter of despotism, right? One of the greatest promoters of despotism that Europe has ever seen. And this is something that struck me because, you know, one way I, you know, whenever I approach a thinker in the history of political thought, the first question I ask myself, this, you know, I got from a reading of philosopher George Grant, right, is that the first question one should ask is, you know, what did that thinker fear the most, right? What is the sum of malum in that person's thought, right? And for Montesquieu, it's despotism, right? In the spirit of laws, it's despotism. So, you know, the fact that he refers to John Law as the greatest promoter of despotism kind of set off alarms, right? So, you know, is he really this enthusiastic, unmitigated promoter of commerce as some of his commentators have presented him? Like, I wasn't so sure, right? And I guess, you know, to go back to your earlier question, moderate liberalism, often the literature will refer to Montesquieu as a radical philosophical liberal, right? And he promotes, he's a radical promoter of commerce, with England being sort of the model, right, that France should emulate. And I'm like, well, he's definitely a promoter of commerce, but I won't call him a radical promoter, right? He's more so. And from there, I came up with the title moderate liberalism, right? Because again, commerce, I acknowledge that commerce is central to understanding Montesquieu's liberalism, because he recognized how our emergent mores and liberal practices, right, were kind of brought forth by modern commerce, right? But he wasn't a radical promoter, because he saw that these same commercial practices could reverse our liberal gains, right? And now his response to that, you won't find it in the Persian letters, but you won't find in a complete response to the problem of the Persian letters. But I think it comes out more clearly in the Spirit of Laws.
Yeah, that's great. The other question I wanted to ask, by way of introduction, is to ask about what I jokingly referred to as the supporting cast of your book, the Hume, Smith, Ferguson. This is an impressive supporting cast, I must say. But maybe Mandeville, say a little bit.
Don't forget about Mandeville and Harrington.
Mandeville, Harrington. Throw them in there. These 18th century luminaries. Maybe say a little bit about their role in your book. I mean, as I read what you're doing, you know, think of those figures as kind of foils to kind of reflect on Montesquieu's own contribution and how he differs from some of these other figures. Is that sure, the right way to think about why you included them?
Yeah, of course. That's a good question. So, yeah, you know, that it's always a question, you know, why do you include these thinkers and not those thinkers? You know, I could have, why not include Rousseau, right, who has an idea of honor tied to like civic virtue, and, you know, there's Tocqueville. But I specifically, so the focus of my project is to tease out this, what I call a pluralistic theory of honor, right, where Montesquieu promotes loftier and forms of honor tied to civic virtue, right, civic engagement, towards a genuine commitment to the public good, and lower forms of commercial honors, like a Mandevillian type honor. And if you look at Hume and Smith, right, you'll find that they each have ideas of honors baked into their liberal projects as well, right? But the difference between, say, Mandeville and Smith-Hume, right, is that for Mandevillian honor, like, the fundamental passion that it's rooted in is vanity, pride, right? It's a self-interested honor that commerce accommodates very well, right? Whereas what you'll see with Hume and Smith, right, there's this idea of honor that's tied to group identification, right, a sense of belonging. And what my book shows is that in Montesquieu's idea of honor, this pluralistic theory of honor, you see both Mandevillian and Humean Smithian modes of honor, right? And I associate the loftier forms of honor in Montesquieu's thought with closer to Hume and Smith. But the reason I included them in my narrative is to show what's distinct about Montesquieu's, how Montesquieu leverages our primordial desire for group identification, right? So for Smith and Hume, they held that commercial society itself, right, through our commercial sociability, our exchange relations, right, we can enliven, right, satiate this impulse for group identification, where Montesquieu did not think that was sufficient, because at the end, self-interest was that primary driver, right? And so he thought that he placed the emphasis on maintaining non-commercial forms of group identification, right? I thought by pressing his thought with Human Smith that I would bring that out in my book.
That's good. So yeah, I wanted to dig in to discuss some of these issues we brought up here in the introduction. I thought the book roughly follows kind of three tracks that we've already kind of brought up. One is the, you could say, the case for commerce and its moderating effects in a new liberal society, the limits of commerce, or the problems of commerce for that very liberalism. And then third, kind of view of honor as a way to address those limits or problems. So just to start with the first one, I mean, thinking about Montesquieu's defense of commerce, and I suppose if you want to throw in Human Smith too, they were also the great defenders of commerce. I mean, what's could you sketch for us briefly kind of the overall case as to what's beneficial about a commercial society on their view?
Yeah, sure. So like I said before, Montesquieu is a promoter overall. He was a promoter of commerce, right? And he simply stated, he thought that it produced the material and cultural conditions, right, that made modern societies free and open, right? So some examples, he thought that our self, in very Mandevillian light, he thought that our self-interested passions could fuel ingenuity, industry, and human prosperity. Right, greed is good if it's properly channeled. He predicted that IR scholars will recognize this proto-interdependence theory, right? Because he thought that international commerce would eventually pacify nations, because as they became more interdependent, he thought that and this is something that Albert Hirschman talks about, emphasizes a lot in his classic commentary, The Passions and the Interests, right? He focuses on this famous passage in Montesquieu's Bird of Laws, where he says that, commerce has cured Europe from the ills of Machiavellianism, right? Which is a testament to how, our calculated pursuit of interest, which is what, the pursuit of gain and profit is all about, will temper the prince's despotic passions, right? But this is an ethos that Montesquieu recognized bubbling throughout the population, right? And commercial innovation, right? One of liberalism's primary features concerns our relationship with nature, right? If you think back to Locke, right? Our mastery over nature, right? For the sake of our, for increasing our prosperity. And Montesquieu recognized how commercial innovation would allow us to overcome some of physical nature's constraints, right? And he even mused about he anticipated how our technological progress could make a world of free of slavery at least conceivable, right? One example that comes to mind, I remember watching an interview or reading an interview with Lee Kuan Yew, right, who was the Singapore's first president, and the interviewer asked them, so how can you explain Singapore's meteoric rise over these last few decades, right? And his simple answer was, well, air conditioning, right? This is because Montesquieu, the reason I'm bringing up this example, because Montesquieu talks about how in southern climates it's it's in having, spending my summers in Greece, I can tell you this, right? When it's 40 degrees every day, it's not, it won't produce the most industrious population, right? But air conditioning has kind of enabled Singapore to overcome this physical constraint of nature, right? Increasing, which in turn increased labor productivity, making people more industrious. You don't have to force labor, right? So it's in innovation. And then finally, Montesquieu recognized how, a la Hume and Smith, commercial exchange relations softens our mores and makes us gentler towards people outside of our immediate tribe, right? These are all features of, you know, all, what I'm listing are all different features, liberal practices, right? And he was of the mind also that this cosmopolitan, it would create this commerce, you know, through our exchange relations with other nations in Europe and overseas would foster this openness towards others' mores and practices. And this was critical for because, you know, we haven't talked about this yet, but in at the core of Montesquieu's thought is this idea of the general spirit, right? Where he instructs or advises legislators to be very mindful of a nation's commercial practices, its climate, its religion, its history, all these things, right? When introducing new laws, right? Because even if a law is good, right, it might upset certain mores and practices, and there may be a resistance, and it might have destabilizing consequences. But Montesquieu recognized, well, you know, if you bring this cosmopolitan openness, right, that commerce fosters will make populations amenable to good laws that they wouldn't have otherwise have been amenable to, right? So these are some of the, this is what excited Montesquieu, right? But some of these features, at the same time, some of these features that I listed, right, if unchecked, can end up becoming sources of despotism, right? So
And that's what I want to turn to next. I mean, because it's an interesting claim. It's not like you're claiming that there are good things and there are bad things about commerce, but it's actually like the very good things themselves can become bad things if, as you say, left unchecked. So maybe you could develop that thought out a little bit. You could develop it out, I guess, conceptually, but you have a lot of great examples too of, you mentioned John Law earlier, and there are plenty of these examples in the 18th century of these, or very early financial crises that I think are, you know, resonant with our contemporary age. You feel free to sort of remind us of those and develop the thought here.
Sure. Yeah. So John Law actually inspired by instituting his system. Which maybe, before I should give just a few remarks what he actually did, right? So he's known for setting up the first central bank in France, right? And his aim was to replace gold and silver, right, as with paper money, right, as a currency, right? Because that would give him greater flexibility with monetary policy and whatnot. And this enabled him, by setting up this general bank, it enabled him to come up with this debt conversion scheme so there's this company called the Mississippi Company. It was a state-owned conglomerate, right? The crown owned it. It was a French company with holdings in the Americas. And what Law did is he merged that company with the bank, right? And instituted this debt conversion scheme that you see companies doing today, right? Where he urged debt holders, people who owned the debt that France was slowly paying off and sometimes not paying off, going having bankrupted several times, he forced them to compelled them to convert those into shares. And the shares became overinflated. And eventually it led to a major crash and everybody lost their money. But Law succeeded in wiping out much of France's debt, right? And economic historians will actually say, well, you know, by monetizing the economy, it actually boosted industry. His scheme actually anticipated a lot of trends in current day capitalism, right? And I think if you look at Montesquieu, you read him closely, and even Adam Smith, because he responds to Law, like they are on one level, they're sensitive, they're sympathetic, I should say, to John Law, right? They don't think that he was some sort of evil genius, right? But There's something about, and Smith talks about this, Montesquieu talks about this, and now I'm getting to the core of your question. There's something about commerce, right, that incites this spirit of commercial improvement, right, where, you know, wherever we see dysfunction, right, in an age of enlightenment, commercial, scientific progress, right, there's this, oh, you know, I could fix this. There's an app for that, right? You know, if you remember one of the Democratic candidates, you know, whenever she was challenged, you know, I got an answer to that. There's an app for that. But there's something about commercial culture that incites that spirit, right? That might make us insensitive, right, to the institutions, the practices, the local mores, right? The intermediate, in the case of France, the intermediary bodies, right, that keep things on an even keel, right? And one of the consequences of law's system is that it weakened France's nobility, right? You know, title holders who served in like the Parlement, and these were important institutions because they kept the crown in check, right? And their primary source of revenue, right, was through issuing debts to the government, right? Issuing debt to the crown, and then, but by through this debt conversion scheme, right, they were compelled to exchange their debt into shares, and then they lost everything. So he saw that it had this it disrupted France's distinctions of rank, right? That in its, and maybe, and the same aristocratic bodies that, to go back to the Persian letters, that Montesquieu lampoons and is scathingly critical towards, right? But at the same time, you saw that in that specific context, they played an important role, intermediary role, in checking centralized power. And this is something that law was not very, wasn't sensitive to. Because again, of this enthusiastic impulse to constantly improve, without thinking about the consequences, the externalities, right, that might result therefrom, and I think we see that that ethos to this very day, right, and I think that spirit of commercial improvement, it's very. It's an ethos that Montesquieu actually, on the one hand, to go back to my earlier point, he admires, because this is what will lead us to inventing air conditioning, right? To making our lives easier, more comfortable, to overcoming some of these obstacles to liberty, right? So he sees that they, but in the world of commerce, that's great. But in and even maybe in managing affairs of state, but the commercial virtues, and this is the key point in Montesquieu that I think he's more sensitive to than Smith and Hume, is that the commercial virtues have their limits in the realm of politics, right? And you needed some other sort of animating principle to keep commerce in check. So to give you like a contemporary example, you know, look at somebody like Elon Musk, right? Again, someone who I think Montesquieu wouldn't look at as some evil genius, right? He's come up with cool electric vehicles, space rockets, but he's someone who just happened to take an interest in politics in recent years, right? And that logic, that ethos, right, might lead to that spirit of commercial improvement without being sensitive to local norms and practices could have adverse consequences. Just one last point on that, what distinguishes Hume and Smith is that they thought that commercial society itself, right, just to being a man of society, right, one who is attuned to the mores, right, to the customs and practices, that would be enough to temper that spirit of commercial improvement. But Montesquieu thought that you needed something outside of commerce to temper that ethos. Right?
This is great. I mean, because it gets to the heart of the concern, I think, you know, because it's particularly interesting, because I think the typical way in which we understand kind of the limits of commerce comes from, I guess, like the broad Marxist tradition, which is something like capitalism can be a problem because it's you know, driven by a profit motive, right? Driven by self-interest, selfishness, to put the, you know, good of the capitalist over the common good. And yes, as you're developing it, Montesquieu's concern is very different. It doesn't have to do with vices, which you might expect from a kind of Mandevillian like Montesquieu, but it doesn't have to do with the vices, but actually the motivation, commercial society for the very kind of innovation and the very, very thing that animates it is also what leads to increased centralization of power. Because government seems to be hungry for that kind of also innovative power. And Montesquieu is a great enemy of centralization. I mean, that all seems right to me. I mean, let me just raise this point. I mean, I wonder if, you know, Montesquieu's view, you know, the problem isn't particularly commerce here. It's government, I guess, right? Like the centralization of the French state, that is, yeah, that France has like centralized its monarchy and so created a space for a kind of crony capitalism, to use kind of contemporary terms. Yeah. It, you know, so in like the spirit of the laws, it's John Law who's the creator of despotism. Montesquieu doesn't say it's like commercial society that's created despotism. It's like this guy, you know. So how much do you think on Montesquieu's view, it's like the particular circumstances of bad actors who are entangling themselves with, you know, the problem of political centralization in Europe? And how much do you think it's actually like commercial society that's really driving the problem? Do you see what I mean?
I do. And, you know, most, I want to go back to what you mentioned, that it's not really commerce in these practices, right? And because we'll look at finance. And now Montesquieu traces the development of these new paper money schemes that he saw coming up in the early 18th century. These, I'll call them financial engineering schemes, right, to use a present term. But he traces it back to the invention of letters of exchange, right, which were these, you know, certificates, right, letters that Jews invented, right, in Lombardy, right, to find a way to engage in commerce without having their property confiscated, right? Because that's, you know, the prince would confiscate the land and property, right? So in a sense, it's this kind of protected them, right? And then over time, as commerce grew, and this goes back to, you know, the Hirschman famous statement, to cure commerce, cure the ills of Machiavellianism, the interests recognize it's in their interest to allow the free flow of commerce, right? Because in the end, the state will gain. And it's not so easy to confiscate. You can't just confiscate land and property because you have this development of mobile capital, right? Of paper and all that. So it was, you could see here how this innovation, right, in finance was actually a major harbinger for enabling liberty, right? But what happened is, as France fell into financial crisis, right, as Louis XIV, like you mentioned, as European countries were becoming more centralized, in France under Louis XIV, this is what was happening, as power was becoming more centralized, and finance was becoming more innovative, it reached a point where these same instruments how finance became an instrument for wielding power over citizens, right? That it's like, oh, wow, now we could, so it kind of, that's just an example, right? How our innovation kind of turn into, you know, as something that enables liberty can all of a sudden become a vehicle for what you said, crony capitalism, right? Or I would call court capitalism, right? That Montesquieu recognized very clearly. And that's where a lot of the scholars who write on John Law, that's what they'll focus on. But, you know, to answer you, the second part of your question, that I still think that there was something about commercial society itself that gave Montesquieu anxieties, right? Which is that, you know, he saw that if unchecked, it might produce this spirit of what he called exact justice, right? Where everything is kind of done for money. You know, the Greek term that he evokes, I think, all the time when it comes to talking about commerce is pleonexia, right? The spirit of avaricious greed that takes firm hold over the population. Again, on the one hand, greed, to cite that famous 1980s movie, greed is good, right? Because it incites ingenuity, innovation, prosperity. But if unchecked, I think Montesquieu was of the mind that this could produce the conditions for despotism. And what he saw in Law's system, right, which gave anyone the opportunity to invest in these shares and become rich overnight, and is he saw that it could foster the spirit of avaricious greed and atrophy the well-developed morals, right, that sustained the political community, right? So there was something about commercial society itself that law system, it's like certain dangers, dysfunctional features, I should say, of commercial society that law system amplified and turned them into a problem, right? So it wasn't just innocent self-interest, but self-interest with no regard for the public good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think I'm more convinced by, you know, the claim that on Montesquieu's view, commerce creates tools and has certain effects that can lead to centralization, right? Like commerce and its the financialization of the economy can like undermine traditional institutions and structures of like aristocratic structures. What's the term, like liquid modernity, right? Like that everything, you know, sort of like, again, to refer to Marx, you know, everything that's solid melts into air under capitalism, you know, these traditional institutions. So it creates a liberty in freeing ourselves from traditional structures, but, you know, but then gives tools to a kind of centralized. And so I think I might agree with that part. I mean, I think the second part, that commerce, you know, kind of arouses a certain desire, you know, a set of desires for sort of universal world domination or something like that. Like, I think that if that's what you're saying, I don't know. I'm a little less convinced. I mean, in part because I think Montesquieu sees that kind of claim, that kind of passion already aroused in earlier European modernity. I mean, like his Rome book, Consideration of the Cause and Greatness of Rome. You know, he's worried about sort of universal monarchy and the ways in which Rome and then Christianity kind of arouse a sort of universalizing ambition on the part of humanity. Maybe is the claim that, you know, that then is kind of added to the commercial universalism, and then that adds fuel to the fire that's already there. Is that what you would say, or what do you think?
No, actually, so, you know, one of Montesquieu's core concerns, again, it's unchecked centralized power, right? And talking in Law, is, and it's clear that Law in many ways his system enabled that. But my book places the accent on another concern that Montesquieu had, which is not so much that, you know, greed will kind of incite this, you know, world domination, as much as how we are in our day-to-day exchange relations, right? It's day-to-day commerce, right? So, you know, maybe I'll come up with like a very specific example. You remember Frances Haugen, she's the Facebook whistleblower, right? Who testified before Congress, where you saw how, you know, the data showed that, you know, Instagram was having this negative impact, especially on teenage girls, right? Seeing suicide rates, you know, whatnot. This is information that, you know, executives in Facebook were aware of, right? But they were too locked into their commercial logic, right, to even recognize, to kind of have some sort of moral check. It's like, hey, right, like we, you know, we can't allow this to continue happening, right? But they were too locked into their earning profit, right, where that consideration for you know, the impact of their commercial practices on the rest of the population did not filter into their decision-making strategies, right? And I think that's what concerned Montesquieu, that self-interested commerce is fine so long as you know, this other regarding spirit is infused in the population, right? It kind of echoes, you know, Montesquieu's concerns kind of echo, I think you interviewed on one of your podcasts, you know, think about Michael Sandel and the tyranny of merit, right? And there's almost a similar concern that you see within in foundational liberal thoughts that my book tries to bring out, Montesquieu, Hume, and Smith, where they held that this, you know, Montesquieu is sort of associated to this, the spirit of exact justice, where everything is done and given for money, right? Atrophying this other regarding impulse that he thought was necessary for commerce to remain in balance, right? And, you know, you mentioned the Parlement played a very important institutional role in France, checking centralized power, but it also played a dual role that my book places the accent on, which is that it inspired the province's well-developed mores, right? Because you had these titled office holders whose honors were associated with ensuring the impartial administrative justice in the various provinces. And so in a sense, their honors were tied to civic honors. And that is something that Montesquieu held that people couldn't help to have reverence for. And they, the you know, there's one famous passage, right, where in the Persian letters, where you know, Yuzbek, he gives this account where, you know, Louis the 14th just died, and he gives a very pedestrian account of Louis the 14th's death, and then proceeds to give this panegyric, right, on the Parlement, where he says, you know, they resemble the ruins for which we tread underfoot, but which always recall to our mind the idea of some temple famous for the ancient religion of the people. They seldom now interfere in anything more than in affairs of justice. Right. And then he laments that, you know, their authority will continue to decline unless that some unforeseen event should arrive to restore life. Now, that unforeseen event that Montesquieu is referring to here is Louis's death. Right. It's clear these parlements, right, it doesn't have that same presence as it had in earlier times. Right. It hasn't been completely, it still plays a presence, right? And it still inspires the public mind on some level, right? Which is why he ends this passage by saying, but the regent, who's referring to the Duc d'Orléans, who wished to render himself agreeable to the people at large, right? Seemed at first to respect this shadow of public liberty, right? So to ingratiate himself with the people, right? He had to pay reverence, right, to these institutions. Why? Because they performed this negative check on the crown? I think there's something more than that, right? It's because they were seen as this honorable institution that ensured the public good, justice, tranquility, and that's something that you know, and as long as something is there, these civic honors are there hovering over the marketplace, I think Montesquieu thought that this would infuse commercial life with a spirit of honesty, right, and other regardedness.
Yeah, that's good. I mean, that gets into the third part of our discussion, which has to do with the honor on Montesquieu's view as a kind of counterbalance or limit. I'm not sure exactly what the best metaphor is here. The kind of excesses of commercial life. So you started to introduce that. Maybe you could kind of deepen a little bit. You talked about, you know, sort of honor on Montesquieu. You thought Montesquieu mentions true honor and false honor, which is interesting. I went back and looked at the very famous discussion of monarchy and the spirit of the laws. And he does say there, true honor and false honor, which I think you line up more, you know, true honor is more on the Smithian and Humean sort of more altruistic side of things and thinking about honor and the way we could sacrifice ourselves for a broader community. Whereas false honor is more the sort of self-interested, vain form of to seeking regards and recognitions for people for our own self-aggrandizement. I'm not sure if that's the right way to characterize true and false honor in your view, but maybe you could develop it. Yeah.
So it might come across like that, but true honor is something that Montesquieu will associate with the civic virtue of like past great republics, right? And I don't think he believed that we could turn the clock back to the ancients, right? False honor is a slippery term in the spirit of the laws, because on the one hand, we can associate it with just simply vanity, pride, that Mandevillian honor, right? The commercial distinctions. But there's also honor as self-regard, group identification, right? Which that, to as I understand Montesquieu, was a loftier form of honor, right? But it still wasn't true honor, right? But it's honor I would call it more self-respect, right? And it was loftier because it was he saw that this is something that could be tied to serving the public good. So there's this institution that Monte, a remnant feudal institution called venality, right? Where successful merchants were able to purchase aristocratic titles, you know, such as in the Parlement, right? And the idea being that, and this is an institution that Louis XIV abused and debased, that Montesquieu has a lot to say about, but the idea was that you can purchase these titles, and then Montesquieu held, you know, in a monarchy, it's important once you purchase these aristocratic offices, you're banned from the world of commerce, right? And so one's self-respect is then tied to serving the public good. Now, is this true honor? No, I don't think it is, right? I think it's more that, this is, you know, this desire for group identification, and this is it, and we perform these acts of civic virtue because this confirms, right, our belonging to this higher group, right? That's sort of what draws people. So in a sense, it's still false honor, right? It's self-serving, but I present honor as a way station, right, to this deeper feeling of justice, right, that I think Montesquieu thinks is just present in human beings, right? I think it's a human nature claim. And there's something about he channels our desire for honors, right, to enliven this impulse, right? Let me give you an example from the Spirit of Laws to explain what I mean. So there's one of Montesquieu's heroes in the Spirit of Laws is this feudal king. His name is Saint Louis, right? He's a famous crusader. And Montesquieu praises him for reforming France's judicial system, right? So let's say if pre-Saint Louis times, you know, if you slighted me and I wanted to take you to court, you know, I would have to challenge you to a duel, and whoever would, and if I would win, then, you know, justice would be served. And Saint Louis, well, that's not fair. So he reformed the judicial system, right? And gave birth to an appeals process, you know, presenting your case before the judge. And this is what gave birth to the Parlement, right? And it's these, and he established this in Paris, right? And his ministers were, and Saint Louis was a crusader. He's like, you know, this is great. You know, we should export this to the other provinces in France by the sword, right? And because, you know, the other provinces still practiced the judicial combat as a way to settle legal disputes. And this is the key point of the story, where Saint Louis said, well, no, because people have this natural reverence for justice, tranquility, peace, security. you know, it was almost like a shining city on a hill statement, right? If people see the good, they'll follow it, right? So he restrained himself from exporting this better legal system, right? Expecting that the other provinces, seeing that it stands out, won't be able to help it. They can't help to revere it, and they'll reform gradually over time, right? And I think that is there's something about civic honor serving the public, right, that enlivens something that's at the core of human beings, right? And I think Montesquieu refers to it as this general feeling of justice, right? That confers some sort of happiness, pleasure, right? And these various false honors, Montesquieu challenged that exist in a large pluralistic society. Montesquieu is looking at how you could channel them to enliven this general feeling, right? That he thought was key to keeping to restraining commerce, to avoiding you know, the Michael Sandel nightmare of commerce, right? Yeah,
good. I mean, this is an interesting reading, Montesquieu. I mean, I guess the way I think, let me just kind of lay on you what the way I kind of have thought about Montesquieu, and maybe I think this is just definitely like a dime store version of this. And so tell me where it goes wrong. I mean, true honor, I think you're right. It seems like connected with ancient republicanism, right? Mm-hmm. Where you're honor is invested in doing great deeds for the community. Mm-hmm. And that's part on Montesquieu's view, you know, something that's past and can't be recovered in modernity. What we have instead is false honor, which is something like in a monarchical system, you know, the courtier spirit, that is the sort of grasping after honors and forms of recognition by sort of petty aristocrats in a monarchical system. And it, you know, it has very little kind of civic mindedness to it, frankly. Everybody's trying to bend the monarch and hence the public to their own particular family interest. But here the particular thing I think with Montesquieu's view is that it's a, you know, there's a kind of proto check and balance system. Like it's like the Federalist Papers, where ambition counteracts ambition. So you can have like this self-interested system, but altogether it sort of adds up to, you know, the public good. So it is like the inheritance of Mandeville then, I guess that's the, so you're developing, I think, something that's different than that. I guess where does that, I guess that view go wrong? Let's tell me that.
Look, Montesquieu, he, you know, to go back to the Persian letters, and he's consistent throughout that, you know, commerce is the organizing principle of the modern world, right? Self-interest is the new monarch, right? So Mandevillian honor, right? And then, you know, Celine Spector, I think she provides the best commentary on this, is quite central in Montesquieu's vision of politics, right? And these will probably constitute most of the honors that people pursue in a commercial society. And it's good because it fuels ingenuity and enables these conditions for liberal practices. But and maybe I should emphasize that this is still central to Montesquieu's thinking about how honor could inadvertently serve the public good because it's grounded in self-interest. But as I understand him, he was of the mind that, you know, for these emerging liberal societies to maintain viable, you need to carve this sphere of public honors that are associated with serving the public good. Now, you know, to go back to this thing about venality, Montesquieu said, you know, once they're serving in these offices, they have to be banned from commerce because there's something corrupting about commerce, right? I think that is the part that's distinct, right? I guess in my reading from other readers of Montesquieu, from people like you know, Andy Bibby writes about this a lot, and Celine Spector, where I agree with him here that you know, this Mandevillian honor is what drives a lot of the prosperity, but there needs to remain this non commercial. So you need to protect honors, political honors from commercial honors. I mean, I'll give you an example. And you know, you brought up the founders. Now, in the Federalist Papers, you'll see more this Mandevillian honor being channeled, right? In federal, I'm thinking you probably had in mind Federalist 51. But if you look at the Federal Convention, Benjamin Franklin gives this wonderful speech, and it was June 2nd speech, where he warns his delegates. He says, you know, we need to create these offices in a way where political titles, political offices are not seen as a vehicle for personal gain and profit. And he actually cites the Parlement and France's system of venality. And he says, well, look, you know, I'm not defending aristocracy, obviously, I'm not defending monarchy, but how do we protect these honors? Because if these commercial honors infuse our political offices, then we won't be able to distinguish the difference between commercial honors and honors that serve the public good. And I think the founders thought it was important. You look at, you know, John Adams, right? Luc Mayville wrote this excellent book on Adams that where I think he draws from Montesquieu on this, right? Adams had this preoccupation with these title distinctions. Right. That why? Because this is false honor, yes, but tied with group identification rather than this Mandevillian honor. I think Adams tried to harness, right, to again prevent, you know, the ethos of oligarchy infusing our institutions. So I'll just leave it at that. I think that's
what's this. No, I mean, this is really helpful. I mean, because it reminds me a little bit of Tocqueville a little bit later, who seems like another heir of this, which is like, you know, aristocracy, you know, we need to like maintain the functional role of aristocracy in a democracy, lest democracy, you know, slide into all these bad things like individualism and tyranny of the majority and whatnot, that aristocrats used to serve as a bulwark against that as sort of institutional forms of liberty. Do I have that right? I mean, is that helpful as a reference point? And, yeah,
for sure. And I think, you know, there are some similarities between, you know, how Montesquieu sees the Parlement and its role in France in his own time, and what Tocqueville observes in the lawyer class, right, in America, sort of as this kind of liaison, right, between centralized power and the rest of the population, but also kind of, but for Montesquieu, for both actually, right, they also serve as a check on centralized power, right, versus, I think, you know, Tocqueville was a very close reader of Montesquieu, and, you know, with Franklin, Adams, and others, you know, later Hannah Arendt, I think Montesquieu looms large in their thought, because each of these thinkers are preoccupied, I think, with protecting political honors, right? These higher, or, you know, forging these higher forms, I won't call them true honors, right? But these higher form of honors that I think they held was essential for keeping liberal societies on even keel, right? They were all preoccupied with this, you know, and I mentioned this in my book, you know, and I'm looking at thinkers who they observed that as liberals, commercial societies are becoming increasingly liberal and open, they wouldn't be able to survive without some sort of aristocratic ethos, right? That checks the excesses of commerce in a sense, right? You innovatively channels these different forms of honor to arrive at that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's good. And I wanted to, this makes a good pivot to the sort of contemporary implications, I think, of your view, because in part, you know, I like a lawyer's reference to Tocqueville, although I don't find it convincing to think that lawyers can serve as a kind of that, you know, the new aristocrats, because that's, you know, it's a class that like famously is very
commercial. You mean like administrators? Did you have in mind, or
sorry, what's that?
Did you have ambulance chasers in mind?
Yeah. Exactly. Ambulance chase. I mean, you know, so maybe there is like a core ethos that's part of some of these white collar jobs that sort of upholds the rule of law in the case of lawyers, or whatever, the Hippocratic Oath in the case of doctors, you know, that resists the sort of pure commercial self-interested motive. But still, I mean, I would hesitate to think that those are good examples of, you know, the aristocratic spirit that kind of maintains itself in liberalism. So I guess, I mean, do you have that stuff in mind, or do you have other things in mind? I mean, what kinds of things do you have in mind as kind of possibilities for how we might think about Montesquieuian aristocratic honor in the contemporary age?
I do have these considerations in mind. You know, as a Canadian, I could come up with a specific example, but I'll park that for a moment. You know, what Montesquieu and his contemporaries saw in their own time was that capitalism, you know, if you look at finance itself, right, these new modes of commerce were also bringing forth new elites, new classes, right? New, quote unquote, new aristocracies, right? And what concerned them is that they did not have these new aristocracies did not have the established mores, right? That and these other aristocratic classes that were tied to consideration for the public good, right? So how do you foster socially, how do you engage with the elites so they can become, to be more other regarding, socially responsible? Now, Tocqueville in early mid 19th century United States, he saw this emergence of the lawyer class, right? Where he saw an opportunity, but you know, I think the best way to read Montesquieu is, you know, you won't find a specific or even Tocqueville in this case, right? You won't, because, you know, there's a distinction, you know, he has general commentaries about democracy and then specific about democracy in America pre-Civil War, right? But it's also the nature of capitalism that society changes. The general spirit evolves, right? You have new aristocracies that emerge, new elites play an inadvertent civic role, whether they are aware of it or not, right? And I think what Montesquieu compels readers to do is to, rather than look at, you know, past, look at Rome or Athens or, you know, some contemporary perfect model for inciting, you know, this civic mindedness, right? Examine your existing institutions as they are. And, you know, are there ways you can leverage these institutions, right, to enliven this public spirit? Now, you know, in Canada, come up with an example, we have an unelected Senate, right? And, you know, it has its problems, right? But, you know, there's, you know, the prime minister appoints the senators, and usually his appointments are people who are, have been successful in their own sphere of the marketplace, right? So we have hockey coaches, successful journalists, hockey coaches won the Stanley Cup, successful journalists, right? Who reach the apex of their honors in the marketplace, right? But now they've been awarded with these higher titles, right? That is more important, right, than these sort of market and it kind of just having these titles, right, that where now you're associated with serving the good, it kind of fosters this hierarchy of value, right? That again, people cannot help to revere. In the United
States, and did their commercial activity honorably, I assume, like that is honestly, not honorably, right?
Right. Yeah, exactly. So you give due consideration to that as well, right? Which inspires the public mind on some level. But you know, to go back to the United States, yeah, I mean, I'm with you. I don't. You know, the lawyer maybe within. Although, right, we do of the three branches of government, right? There is. I still think to this day the Supreme Court has the greatest reference, right, of the three branches, right? So there is something about legal culture in the United States, right? I see, as an outsider, I still see it as a very litigious culture, right? So it's something that that might be leveraged, right? Like Montesquieu tried to revivify and rebuild the Parlement, right, to its what it was in the past, right? You know, perhaps there's we shouldn't completely give up on America's lawyer class, right? But I also see, you know, this take that what we were talking about before, that spirit for commercial improvement, right? You know, there's a passage in Smith's Theory of Moral Sentiments where he says, you know, this spirit of commercial improvement, if you know, it can actually, through the study of politics, right, it can actually incite the public spirit in a sense, right? Like we want to see, you know, you study your institutions, your imperfect past. It may incite this spirit among citizens to improve, right, wherever there's dysfunction, which he thought that, you know, could be channeled in positive ways. So, you know, if I look at in the United States, you know, maybe constitutional studies, civics, right, an honest study of our past might incite these commercial honors. But I think Montesquieu would, you know, trying to kind of climb to today, he was also very weary, as we discussed before, how this, you know, spirit of improvement can lead us awry, right, having this insensitivity to specific practices. So what he urges readers, you know, in the preface of The Spirit of the Laws, he says, there's this weird quote where he says, you know, I would be the happiest of mortals if I could convince my reader to love their country, their laws, their government, you know. And I consider myself so blessed that I was born in France to have my king and everything. And, you know, the way I read this, it's not, because at the same time, you know, the Persian letters and throughout even The Spirit of the Laws, Montesquieu is scathingly critical of France, its practices. You know, it's on the edge of despotism, right? You have all these despotic ideas, practices that, but at the same time, he's, I think, urging his readers, you know, be careful. And this is a, I think, an important message today, as we see even scholars pointing to, like, perhaps a post-liberal order, right? And liberalism as kind of where, you know, Montesquieu is saying that, well, hold on, let's not throw out the baby with the bathwater, right? Examine, I'm going to present the great Rome, you know, great Roman Republic and Athens, and I'll show you how great England is doing with its commercial prosperity, right? So the Spirit of the Laws is a survey of all these different regimes and institutions, but then it ends with this long, torturous study of France's institutional history, right? Going back to like the 5th, 6th century. And why is he doing that? Because I think he's compelling readers that, you know, in the end, you know, you're going to examine your own institutions, right? Where are the sources of liberty that are contained within your own institutions before looking at something beyond, right? And I think that is something that Montesquieu's epistemic approach to studying to politics, and that is what enabled him to identify existing honor-yielding institutions, i.e. the Parlement, right, that could be channeled, improved, right, to contain commerce. And he's challenging us to do the same thing, to look at our own institutions. I look at, like I mentioned, the university, constitutional studies, right? In the United States, I think, you know, studying the Constitution is could be a part of that. I don't know if you had any reflections on.
No, those are all good examples. I mean, Montesquieu is pointing to the past and the importance of tradition, political traditions. I mean, I think it puts him in the line with Burke too, right? I mean, in thinking about the ills of the French Revolution and the ways in which it's sort of abandoning its ancestral past. And, you know, there's a worry about the modern age and too much emphasis on any one thing, including commercial society, can be abandonment of the many sources of liberty.
I'm glad you brought up Burke, because, you know, there's a famous allegory in the Persian letters. It's called The Tale of the Troglodytes, right? Where, you know, even interpreters to this day, they there's a spirited scholarly disagreement, right? And it begins with the main character being pressed by one of his friends to elaborate on something he said in an earlier discussion, where he said that, you know, what did you mean that justice is something that's natural to human beings as virtue itself, right? And Yuzbek responds, and this is key, where he goes, well, you know, there's certain truths referring to justice that we cannot just understand in the abstract. They need to be felt, right? And then proceeds to give this allegory where you have these troglodytes, which to me is an interesting term, because troglodytes means pre-commercial, pre-civilized, right? And where they become, at a certain point, they're, he gives us this trajectory history of the troglodytes, where they governed themselves according to self-interest. That was what their first constitution was based on, but that kind of went awry. And then they remodeled themselves into a republic that kind of operate that kind of will evoke memories of like Rome or Athens. But then the story ends with, you know, as commerce increased, people, the troglodytes were too preoccupied with their material ends. So they appoint a king, right, to a virtuous king, right, to give them their laws, right? And then the tale ends with the king lamenting, you know, that and warning them that, you know, you're giving up your liberty, right? Now in that allegory, right, these troglodytes, they're at their happiest during these classic republican times, right, where they're these they're at their most just, right? They're engaged in civic life, and it ends with a lament where, you know, on the one hand, we cannot turn back the clock to this ancient past, right? But then on the other hand, justice is not something that can just be practiced by having an understanding of it in the abstract, right? By these principles in the abstract, right? It can only be felt through our engagement with our institutions, right? To feeling through our through institutional life. Right. And I think that is why, I think that's a proto-Burkean message, and that Montesquieu prefaces his great work, The Spirit of the Laws, right, where he says, you know, he'll be the happiest of mortals, right, if we can find new ways to like our institutions, right, because he acknowledges that, yeah, you know, maybe we're on the precipice of moral degeneration, but warns us, you know, rather than getting rid of these institutions, well, let's harness these institutions that still inspire some general feeling of justice and nourish them, right? And I think that's a core message throughout The Spirit of the Laws. And it's something that Montesquieu employs to develop a response to the his anxieties about, you know, the shadow side of commerce and how it could lead liberal societies awry.
Great. Well, this has been a lot of fun, Constantine. Thanks again for joining me on the Political Theory Review.
I appreciate the opportunity. Thank you, Jeff. I look forward to seeing you in a couple of weeks.
Mm-hmm. You've been listening to the Political Theory Review. Find us on the web and on iTunes. Thanks to the Starting Points Journal for partnering with us. And thanks to you for listening.